I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. We're going to talk about the remarkable story of James Howard Billy Williams, whose uncanny rapport with the world's largest land animals transformed him from a carefree young man into the charismatic war hero known as Elephant Bill. What I've learned from reading this book is that elephants are amazingly intelligent and sensitive. Some say they are especially good at detecting the nuances of human emotion, that they understand the concept of death and grief, and they are capable of sophisticated humor. These behemoths are apparently also capable of bravery. The world knew that during World War II, when a man named Billy Williams was stationed in remote Burma as a sort of elephant keeper as part of his job. The elephants he oversaw convinced him of their exceptional abilities, often like our own, and it turns out as capable of violence as humans are. The elephants surrounding Billy Williams saved him in Burma and helped him battle the Japanese. Williams received Britain's top honors and said in his many interviews back then, when he was known worldwide, that his elephants taught him more than any human. His story is told in a riveting way in this book, Elephant Company. Author Vicki Constantine Croker, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Faith.
Nice to have you here. So, and I should say Croak, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Let's describe how he starts out. So he's out of World War I, and he decides to get a job in the remote forest of Burma. Who's he working for?
Billy Williams was someone who came out of World War I like a lot of young men, and that is he didn't have any physical wounds, but it had been very traumatic to him emotionally. And he wanted to get away from it all, and here was someone who was a true, true animal lover, had been kind of born that way. And you couldn't get further or more exotic than Burma in 1920. It was far, far away. It was teeming with animals, jungle-laden country. And Billy Williams heard that the Bombay-Burma Trading Corporation was hiring young men to come and work in the logging industry. And the thing that sold him was that he found out he would work with elephants. And so he signed on. He was one of the men who passed the test because they were very picky about who they would hire. And meanwhile, they had no idea who would really make it. These were tough, tough forests. It was hard to survive. And they basically would hire their best guesses for recruits and put them out in the forest and see who survived and who either died or came running back screaming.
Yeah, and only, as I recall, didn't you say 4% made it through the experience?
Yes, 3 or 4% was the figure that was assumed at the time. And
So why were the elephants being used in this forest region by this company?
It's really fascinating. And by the way, in Myanmar today, they are used in the same way, and it may be their saving grace. It may be the reason that there are still so many elephants in that country. And that is that the elephants were used to go into the forest and drag the logs of the teak trees that had been cut down to the waterways. It's a very mountainous country, lots of rivers and streams, and so there aren't good roads. And the only way to move the lumber from the forest down to the mills would be to get the logs to a stream. And in monsoon season, when all the rivers fill up, the wood floats down and makes its way towards the mill. So the elephants were crucial to moving tons and tons of wood, which was absolutely coveted at the time.
So he's on this long journey, Billy Williams, and he finally gets to this remote region in Burma, this forest region where all these elephants are. And it's quite a scene when he first gets to the camp. An unfriendly director is there. But his first sighting of these giant creatures, these elephants, that's quite a scene. Can you talk about that?
It's remarkable. He has a very unwelcoming boss, Willie Harding, who's really intent on finding out if Billy really has the stuff to make it here or not. And if he doesn't have the stuff, Harding kind of wants to know before Billy ever leaves camp that he can't make it so he can send him back. But he's sitting with his boss, and the elephants enter camp. There are seven elephants, and they're silent. They're practically silent. Their big feet allow them to walk in just like clouds. They sort of float in like clouds. And the only thing that he hears is the scraping of their skin from their ears, the little bit that they touch trunks to one another. And their kalooks, they wear these beautiful teak bells around their necks. Each bell is carved by their own handler, or uzi they're called here, mahout in other countries. Those teak bells are their signature sound.
Vicki, do me a favor and speak up a little bit. I know it's intimate because sounds like we're having pals having a phone call. but you know, talk right into your mouthpiece because I want to make sure folks listening in cars can really hear you because this is a great story.
So he meets his first group of elephants who are working elephants. They're travelers, which are the elephants who are assigned to move these recruits around the forest. And this is his first sighting of elephants. They're beautiful. They're amazingly quiet. The only sound he's hearing is a little bit of the rustling of their skin when their ears flap or when they touch one another. And these teak kalooks,
The bells, yeah.
The bells that they wear around their necks. And each of the uzis carves his own elephant's bell, and so that he can tell the sound of his own elephant in the forest and distinguish that elephant from the other ones.
Now, in the beginning, does he detect, human ears, I gather, cannot hear this particular low rumble. We can hear part of it, but not all of it. That elephants, you say, can communicate with each other up to a distance of 5 miles,
That's exactly right, Faith. And this is one of the most remarkable things about elephants. And within the last couple of decades, our scientists have discovered, Katie Payne, in fact, that elephants use this low-frequency sound along with their repertoire of other sounds. Low-frequency sound can travel over very long distances, and so they can communicate with one another when they're separated by miles. And it explains something that in today's world, scientists who would be up in airplanes in Africa would see groups of elephants seem to coordinate their movements. They'd be up in the plane, they'd see elephants below, separated by miles, suddenly almost pivot at the same time and head toward one another. And they used to laugh about it and call it elephant ESP. And in fact, that elephant ESP turned out to be the low-frequency rumbles. For Williams and for people who are close to elephants, they experience that sound often as a vibration in your chest. You would hear the upper part of the sound, so you could hear partially that sound, but you would also be feeling something deep in your chest. And he grew to love and know that sensation.
So he's in charge of overseeing people and also the work of these elephants carting these logs into the rivers so that they can flow down to where they're supposed to be, these teak logs. As time goes on, I mean, this Billy Williams, as you describe in the book, grew up with this intense love and a kind of amazing ability to communicate with animals. But so he's very sensitive to them, and these elephants, being what they are quite sensitive to him. How does this begin to be something extraordinary in the way that he can communicate with them?
It's almost immediate, Faith. He meets the elephants, and he begins to see things right away. That very first group of elephants, he thought he caught humor in the eye of the male elephant. When the elephant was being ordered to lie down and to stand up, he thought he saw the elephant doing what he was told, but kind of rolling his eyes about it all. And also on his very first trip within weeks of arriving in Burma, he is sent into the forest on his own, not speaking the language yet, with the men who will work for him who speak no English, and a group of elephants of his own. And as soon as they leave Harding's camp, his boss's camp, there is a commotion. And two elephants, one elephant back at camp is crying out, and one elephant who is with him in his group is crying out. And the elephant with him suddenly breaks away and runs back to camp. And he learns a couple of things from that. One is these elephants, even if they're not related and they don't have the kind of mother, sister, daughter dynasties that we see in the wild, these elephants still form very intense bonds with one another. And he learned right away it would be cruel to separate them. These elephants who form bonds should be allowed to work together. And so in that very first case, within his first day setting out on his own, two elephants who had been separated, the humans gave in and allowed the elephants to rejoin and to be with one another. So right away, he begins to see some remarkable things in these elephants, and he becomes a field biologist. He's out on his own, and he takes his fountain pen and his little two-penny notebook, and he begins to do something extraordinary, which is he marches during the day with the elephants through the jungles. But at night, the elephants are released, as they are today in Myanmar. They work 4 or 5 hours a day, and then the elephants are released to be almost like wild elephants at night. They sleep very little, and so they go into the jungle at night. They socialize as wild elephants do. They forage as wild elephants do, and they often even mate with wild elephants. So Billy Williams, who is fascinated by these creatures, realizes, I'm not going to really understand these animals just by watching them work, just by watching them cart around my kit, my gear. I'm going to go into the forest at night, which was an extremely dangerous thing for him to do, to be following not only these working elephants, but, of course, they're interacting with wild elephants in the forest.
And some of these elephants, I'm sorry, Vicki, go ahead.
He realizes he feels safe with them. He feels like he knows them, and he does something that his boss would have just murdered him for going into the forest to do that. And he begins to act as a field biologist and to note their behavior in the wild. And it's the beginning of his very, very long love affair with these creatures.
This is Vicki Constantine Croke. She is author of Elephant Company. This is a nonfiction book that reads like a novel. It's about the heroism of World War II's Billy Williams and the elephants who saved and protected him as he protected them in the Burmese jungle. We're going to get to his battles, the things that these elephants did for him. It is really quite something. I should mention that during the day, back in this day, Billy Williams was famous all over the world. Articles about him were printed everywhere, the New Yorker, everywhere, and people would read about him. He was heroic for the kinds of things he was, like an elephant whisperer, right?
That's right. He became famous during World War II, but a big part of the story was what he was doing in World War II, which is that he understood elephants in a way that one newspaper said no white man normally could. And so he was celebrated in World War II in all of those publications that you named. And interestingly, so many of them talked about his ability to rule the elephants, to get elephants to do what he wanted to do. But he really felt, and I felt, the reason I took on this project was, I thought the real story was what the elephants had done for Billy Williams, and he said they made him the man he was in a way that no human being could have.
I want to get you to talk about that very thing. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back to talk more about Elephant Company. Stay with us. I'm Faith Middleton. We know you are piling into the show, so I want to catch you up. We're talking with Vicki Constantine Croke, author of Elephant Company. This is technically a nonfiction book, although it reads like a fiction, and it's about the heroism of World War II's Billy Williams. This is a true story, and the elephants who saved and protected him as he protected them in the Burmese jungle when we were battling Japan. We're going to get to what that battle was like. So he talked, Vicki, about how the elephants did so much for him, and they did help in the battle. What did he mean by that?
They made him, I think in many ways, here was a guy in his formative adult years in the jungle. So just as most of us, whatever our workplace is, we learn from the people that we work with, and he worked with some human beings, but he largely worked with elephants. And he found in them a kind of character that he thought was almost above that of human beings. I mean, he just thought that they were courageous. They taught him how to trust and when not to trust. He thought they had a tremendous sense of humor. And he learned from them how to be a leader and not a bully. I mean, some of life's most important lessons, he was in the forest to learn them, and he learned them directly from the elephants. He learned how to not be pushed around. He learned that you could stand up for yourself without battling to the death. He learned that life was learning to negotiate life with other people. He saw the big bulls testing one another, but not killing one another for the most part. And all of these things he brought to bear in his own life and the way he dealt with other human beings.
Having said that, there is a danger of turning elephants into a Disney movie. Mm-hmm. And so as remarkable as they are, to get rid of, just as in humans, there's a range of aggression in people, there's a range of aggression in these animals.
That's absolutely right. And what Billy Williams used to say is that he thought that truly wicked elephants were as rare as truly wicked men. And there were rogues among the ranks of these logging elephants. What's interesting is that they were so expensive to buy one of these trained working elephants that if an elephant killed someone, they were not either executed or turned back into the wild. They were simply given a metal bell around their neck so that everyone around them would be warned that this was a killer elephant. And they were assigned not only a rider, but a person holding a spear. And they went back to work. So in the ranks of the elephants were known killers. And anyone who worked for the logging company knew who they were and knew how to deal with them.
He describes, you do actually, in your book, this incident talking about the humor that these elephants were capable of. He explains that there was one standing by the river, and it had taken the teak logs, as it was expected to do, right up to the edge of the river and was supposed to do what it normally does, which is to drop those logs into the water, this massive creature. And would you describe that scene where the elephant is playing a joke?
This is the famous Bandula, and if there is an elephant lead character in this book, it is Bandula. I'm in love with Bandula. Tall, magnificent, gorgeous elephant. And he was famous for, first of all, everyone who worked in Burma in the teak company would always have claimed to have worked with Bandula because he was such a magnificent, intelligent animal. And everyone reported the scene where Bandula was a big guy. He could move the biggest logs, and he would do that. He'd bring a log right to the edge of a creek or a river, but then he would pretend he couldn't push it anymore, and he would actually mime putting his shoulder into it and trying with all his might to move the log another inch, and he couldn't do it. His rider would always know that he was fooling around. The rider would say, "Come on, Bandula, stop kidding around, just move the log in." Bandula would do his little mime for a little longer. And then when he had had enough of his own joke, he would just flick that log into the water with it just effortlessly. And everyone who ever worked with Bandula would claim that as soon as he did it, you could actually see him laugh.
Right. It was some kind of a low rumble.
That's right.
That you could detect.
And you can see, if you've been around elephants, you can read joy on their faces. And they squint. They make this high squeaking noise, which is a happy noise. Their cheeks go up tight, and their faces sort of like a human smile. So you can see an elephant. You can see it when an elephant is joking.
Vicki, in our next segment, I want to be sure to open the phone so that people can talk with you about what you've learned about these elephants, whether people might know about this story, remember this story from the time of World War II. I want to ask you how you came upon it again after it was famous back then. So let's get to how Bandula or some of the other elephants helped save Billy Williams.
Bandula in particular, he and Williams are almost twins, human and elephant. They were born in the same month, in the same year, and the course of their professional lives in the forest paralleled perfectly. And also, I mean, Williams was someone who was pretty spiritual. Some people would have called it superstitious, and he loved all elephants, but the moment he met Bandula, he describes in really spectacular cosmic terms. And he put his palm against Bandula's hide, and he felt something pass between them, like the meeting of souls. So this elephant in particular was his favorite, and he worked closely with Bandula throughout his time, always tried to be near him, though there were many camps. And they each saved one another's lives. Bandula was in a horrific fight with another, with a wild tusker, and was injured and needed to be doctored for a year, which Williams did. And Williams himself became, all of these guys who worked in the forest were constantly beset with malaria, dysentery, a kind of fungus that would make them break out all over in their skin and their lymph nodes, a swell. And one of the times that Williams was at his absolute sickest, he needed to get to a civilization. He was deep in the forest, and it was Bandula who brought him across a raging river during monsoon when no one thought that any animal or any person could get across. And so Bandula also saved Williams' life.
I am remembering that scene as you wrote it. It's such a good scene where the river is raging, and despite the size of Bandula, who was just a magnificent creature, one slow step, and with each step, deep, deep into the mud, and then trying to extract that foot and take the next step with this raging torrent, just to get this man, to, you know, this person clearly he loved, to the other side and on to where he needed to go. Amazing.
It is, you can't help but see it in heroic terms. It was a huge physical effort. And the thinking is, from every current researcher I've spoken to, these elephants are absolutely in tune. They certainly, a male elephant can tell if a female elephant is receptive, if she will have sex. And he can tell it by dipping his trunk into her urine. Now, our scientists, our chemists, cannot take elephant urine and tell that same thing about her estrous cycle. So elephants are master chemists. They can read our mood and our minds, and they certainly can pick up on chemical cues. And there's no doubt that at the time that Williams was this sick and he was barely conscious, that Bandula, the elephant, was aware of his state.
And tell us, does Bandula, I mean, I know this story because I've read your book, but tell us, does Bandula get him to where he's supposed to go?
He does. Bandula comes through.
Right. So now, let's get to the war part of this, because here he is in Burma. He's working for this company, this British teak company, but there is also war. And how do the two of them become involved in this war?
When war broke out, and Williams always knew that that the war would come to Burma, though many of his colleagues and his fellow countrymen in colonial Burma thought that the country would be left alone. In fact, this is the part of the war, this is the longest raging part of World War II, took place in Burma. Nearly about 1 million Burmese people died during this long, horrible warfare between the Allies and the Japanese. And Williams, first of all of the English citizens in Burma, early on in the war when it came there, were evacuated from Burma. So Williams, along with his colleagues, his countrymen, and soldiers, were evacuated to India. But he was really itching to get back. He was a very patriotic man. He thought he could fight for his country, and he knew what he could do was, if he got back into Burma, he could round up the elephants who remained. He knew they would be in hiding in the forest, and he could work for the Allied officers. Initially, the army thought what the elephants would do is carry supplies, but he knew they could do a lot more than that. And what ended up happening, he went back in behind enemy lines. He put the word out that he was looking for all of his old Uzis, the riders who used to work for him, to bring their elephants to him. And one by one, he built up an elephant army that would number 1,600 elephants at the largest point in the war. And he built, with his elephants, 270 bridges, which was a huge and miraculous effort. And that helped the soldiers move in, come back, the Allied forces to come back into Burma to bring their tanks in and eventually, obviously, win the war there. But the crucial part of building those bridges has been cited by other historians as being a very important element in winning the war.
Isn't this amazing? Honestly, it is just amazing to think about this man going back into that jungle and saying, I'm going to make a company of elephants to do this work. But the Japanese also wanted to use the elephants, too, right?
That's right. The elephants were coveted by both sides. This is a place without roads. The railways only went so far. So if you wanted to move your troops around in this country, you were going to use elephant power to do that. And elephants were legitimate targets for pilots on both sides. So pilots dropped bombs on the elephants and shot at them if they thought that they were on the other side. Williams himself hated the way the Japanese had treated his elephants. When they got elephants back from the other side, often they would have been mistreated, they would be starving, and the worst thing is that they carried battery acid, and often that spilled on their backs, and they would have horrendous burns on their backs. So it became his mission not only to build up his own ranks for the Allied forces, but to get elephants back for their own safety.
This is Vicki Constantine Croak. She is author of Elephant Company. It's a nonfiction book, a true story about the heroism of World War II's Billy Williams, and who received the Order of the British Empire, and his company of elephants who saved and protected him as he protected them in the Burmese jungle, and they all fought in the war together. There is a scene where these elephants are asked to do what would be impossible for some humans to do, especially me, and that is to walk a path that was so dangerous, and they do it. Can you describe this scene for me?
This is one of the most remarkable things that I've ever learned of, and that is just before the big battle for Burma, which took place in Imphal. His commanders, Billy Williams' commanders, told him that he needed to get the elephants that he had out of that area. They wanted them across into the safety of India so that when the battle was done, the elephants could come back in and resume their work. So he set about bringing a big group of his elephants 120 miles from Imphal further into India. And basically, the night before they were leaving for this journey, he was saddled with a group of 64 refugees, women and children, who had been taken prisoner by the Japanese and needed to find their way to safety. I want to make sure that I describe that in Imphal, at this very moment in history, the battle lines were being drawn. All of the Japanese soldiers in the area were racing to this point, as were the Allied forces, and all hell was just absolutely breaking out. And it was going to be difficult enough for him to cross over five mountain ranges between where he was and where he needed to be with his elephants. And elephants aren't big mountain climbers, so already this was a very serious task he had before him. And now he was taking on these very sick and injured refugees, many of whom had to ride on elephant back to make it to the other side. But he took it on. As it would turn out, they had something like 15 days supplies with them, and it would take 21 days. The travel was really arduous. They're going up mountains, 5,000 feet plus mountains. The elephants sometimes had to do without water, which is something that was very difficult. And the most spectacular thing that happened, that with the Japanese completely surrounding them at their backs, they come to a cliff face that goes for miles in every direction, and it's 270 feet high. And they are up, literally up against a wall, not knowing how he's going to get his elephants past this cliff. The enemy, no one wanted to be taken prisoner by the Japanese. It was mostly that people would be tortured, bayoneted, women would be raped. So there was no going back when they come to this wall. And they make this remarkable decision that they're going to build into the wall that has some natural outcroppings an elephant stairway and get the elephants to climb 270 feet up what is basically a sheer wall. And
up a staircase.
An elephant stairway. And no one in his group, including Williams, had any idea if this really crazy idea would work. But they had absolutely no choice. And they had a group of 53 elephants. When I think about this, when I just stop and think that you're in the jungle and you face this sheer cliff that on its own, Billy Williams wasn't sure he could climb on his own, and you're going to ask 53 elephants to climb rock. So they took a couple of days. The rock was soft enough for them to expand on some of the stairs that were there. They pulled down all of the vegetation that was blocking some of the width of the stairs. And they kind of thought they were on a suicide mission, and they asked as their first elephant to lead the other elephants, Bandula. And they knew that if Bandula made it, the other elephants would follow him up. But you can imagine that if just one elephant halfway up this 270-foot cliff got scared or fell, they would take down the whole line of elephants behind them.
Also, what strikes me in reading that section is that this is an animal that if it doesn't perceive what's really or understand what's really going on, is going to look at something like this stair contraption on the edge of this path along the face of a cliff, where you can see straight down. Vicky, how far down did it go? And you just tumble to your death, right?
Absolutely. There'd be no, if any of one of those elephants slipped, it would be death for that elephant and for any of the elephants or human beings who were coming along underneath. And this would take 3 hours for each elephant to make it from the bottom to the top. So we're talking about a huge journey. And
right.
These powerful elephants, including Bandula, who came to the top, their muscles and their legs were shaking for an hour after they had made it to the top.
Yeah. So this elephant has to somehow understand that it's being asked to do this crazy thing for the first time. It can look down and see with its own eyes how dangerous this is, and then undertake this with a sense of incredible trust, as if it's hard not to anthropomorphize, as if it understood this is my only way to be saved. I've got to trust this situation.
It's hard to parse exactly what they were thinking, but what we know, and it's interesting to me because Field Marshal William Slim, who was one of the most decorated and celebrated generals in any of the military theaters of World War II, knew Billy Williams and his work well. And one of the things that he said about this very moment, this huge, obviously pivotal moment in Billy Williams' life, is that the reason the elephants followed Billy Williams is because of the 25 years he had spent in the forest with these animals. They knew him. He always knew. He became a de facto veterinarian. They didn't have any other veterinarian at that time. He would even perform surgery on some of these elephants. They learned to trust him. They learned to trust that whatever medical procedure he was doing, even if it hurt them, was for their own good. And so we can only guess that part of the connection and part of the reason that these elephants were willing to do what they did that day is because of that long history they had with this man, particularly Bandula, whom the other elephants would follow. And they trusted him. I don't think it's anthropomorphizing to say that. What we know is that elephants form very strong bonds with one another, and we know that they're capable of doing it with human beings. And so something kind of miraculous happened that day. And we've got to look at it from a very scientific point of view, that they had formed, particularly Bandula, had formed a bond with this man that was very similar to the kinds of bonds they would have with one another.
All right, Vicky, stay where you are. We're going to open the phones at 203-776-WNPR and come back and talk more about this true story, Elephant Company during World War II. We'll be right back. I'm Faith Middleton, and I would like to thank our producers, Lori Mack and Jonathan McNichol, and Marion Roy for production assistance throughout the week. We appreciate it so much. And thank you for listening. We are talking with Vicky Constantine Croak, if you're just joining us. She's author of this book. It's a true story, Elephant Company. It is a nonfiction book about the heroism of World War II's Billy Williams. and the elephants who saved and protected him as he protected them while we were in the middle of this fight in the Burmese jungle. Only 4% of the men who were in that jungle working for a British tea company or others, and during the war, only 4% came back. So millions were killed during this battle, and these elephants, this man formed a company with these elephants, over 100 of them, and they built bridges. They did so much to win the territory. So, Vicky, the elephants make it across this incredible trek with these refugees, and then what happens for the rest of the war?
They get the refugees to the refugee camps in India, and the elephants have an opportunity to rest for something like 4 months in India. They weren't popular among the tea planters in India because that's where they were allowed to forage for a good long time. But once they had rested up and got their good body condition back, they all trooped back into Burma and did some of their most important bridge building during that time. One of the important things that happened with the bridge building is there was something invented and used for the first time in World War II called Bailey bridging, which was lightweight bridge segments that they could form a bridge across, it was lightweight, and they could carry it with them, the soldiers, and form bridges across big riverways. And because the elephants had made so many of these bridges that they normally would in their regular work out of the wood at hand, that the Bailey bridging material didn't get used up, and it was used in one place along the Chinwin River, and is considered a really pivotal moment in the war. So what the elephants did for the Allied forces is truly significant and recognized by the very top leaders of the British forces.
What I'm curious about is how much poetic license you took for this. There might be a scene where, say, it would be like this. Billy Williams comes out of the tent and walks to this rise, and he can feel the breeze on his. And as I'm reading, I'm thinking to myself, now, how do you know that? Tell me about that.
So I have something like, 2,000 endnotes? And I take no license, actually, Faith. It's something I pride myself on. What I do have at hand were not only the memoirs that Billy Williams wrote himself and his wife wrote, and then I have a lot of material, archival material from the family that was never published. But Billy Williams wrote at great length and recorded many of the details. And then what I use is weather reports of the time. And I use reports from colleagues of his in newspapers and can stitch together that kind of material. And I also had family members who could tell me stories that were never published. And so we were able to stitch together some pretty intimate portraits of what actually happened.
Well, I set you up to talk about that because I, in fact, read your end notes and thought, wow, what a job you did of weaving all this material together. When I say it reads like a novel, I mean it. I certainly was so eager to talk with you and read this book after reading the New York Times review. You must have been over the moon.
Incredible. That was incredible.
It was, excuse me. So we can't leave this conversation. By the way, if you want to join us and excuse me, talk with Vicky about her work and what happened in this story, here's our number, 203-776-WNPR, 203-776-9677. Vicky, we can't end this conversation without knowing what happens to Bandula.
Bandula ends up being a mysterious and sad end. Bandula does not live to the end of the war, though strangely, it is believed that he was not killed by enemy fire, that he may have been killed. He was shot, and his body was found by Billy Williams, or he was shown where Bandula's body was. And Billy Williams had a theory of who killed Bandula and why. I don't know that that's really what happened to Bandula. We know that someone killed him. Billy Williams felt that it was the person who trained Bandula, who had lived his life with Bandula, Potok, a master elephant trainer, and that he may have been out of his mind during the war, because of the war itself, because he was afraid of being separated from his elephant. And that was Billy Williams, his guess, his theory about what happened to his beloved Bandula. What I can tell you is that when Billy Williams saw Bandula dead, he kind of went out of his mind. He describes himself, he stopped all work that he needed to be doing for the army. He wanted to know who did it. He set up his own inquiry. And I think that he had basically a nervous breakdown in the face of seeing this elephant who was truly like a brother to him for decades.
Yes, and a very famous elephant. I mean, people admired this elephant for his majestic quality, his physical beauty, his size. You know, it's like the white shepherd or the black stallion. You know, there's always one,
yes. You
know, that is just so beautiful that it's awe-inspiring. And so that was this elephant. But this elephant became famous all over. There's a plaque, right?
Well, Williams set up a plaque for him because he helped soldiers, he doctored human soldiers, and he said that he felt the same feeling seeing a human soldier injured that he did for these elephants, and he felt how wrong it was. He believed in the elephants. He knew that they could help the Allied forces, but he felt horrible to the bottom of his heart that elephants were left to have to help fight human wars. And he also felt that they should be recognized for the heroes that they were during the wartime. And so he did set up a plaque for Bandula. And he always felt that their names should have been recorded somewhere as the names of human soldiers were.
Mm. And what happens to Billy Williams? He gets married, by the way, and has a family in this Burmese jungle. But go ahead.
It's a very romantic story, too, to imagine. He truly met his soulmate in the jungle, and they went on to lead a very, very... She was someone who was in love with animals in the jungle as much as he was, and so they had a wonderful married life together. Billy Williams, as sometimes happens with people like this, he was... Burma and the elephants were his purpose in life, and when the war was over and he left Burma, I think he kind of lost his way a little bit. He never again... felt that sense of purpose. He was a hero himself, and he was a magnificent survivor, and he could handle any situation. And he came home to England, and he wasn't sure what to do with himself, basically. One of the most poignant moments in his life to me was years after returning to England, not finding exactly what he should be doing with his life, he gets a call from someone in running a circus, and asked him to come and have a look at one of the elephants. And so Billy Williams travels to the circus, and he is once again immersed with a group of elephants. They're circus elephants. They're Asian elephants that he's used to. And he comes alive again. Not only that, but this is the moment that really gets to me. When it's time for him to say goodbye to the elephants, he starts to walk away, and then he suddenly has this feeling that he can't even describe, and he takes off. He turns around. He pivots back around. He goes back toward the elephants. He takes his coat off, and he rubs the lining of his trench coat against the bodies of the elephants so that he can retain their scent just a little bit longer and take it home with him. And I think that says it all, that this man who so loved elephants that he said they became his religion and that he became an elephant really wasn't as much of a man without them, and he really felt their loss.
Yeah. How he's awarded for his gallantry in facing the enemy. He's awarded the Order of the British Empire,
which is an incredible military honor for bravery, and it really gives us a sense of the contribution that he and the elephants made during World War II. So he was someone who became known not only in the dispatches from the war. Correspondents for newspapers and magazines around the world were there. They all did stories on him and Bandula. When he left, he also was written up in newspapers and magazines, and he began to write memoirs and to tell his own story. And in that, he got a little sense of himself back. But he died fairly young, and it's kind of tragic. He died of a burst appendix, and he had had so many physical problems from the jungle, and he had learned to be so stoic about any pain in his gut that it's believed that he just didn't get medical care in time because he was just putting up with that pain.
But also something eerie when he ends up having a son, and the son goes off to train to school to become a vet, and doesn't Billy Williams whisper to his wife, "This is the last time I will see him"?
They're waving goodbye to Treve, his son, who's going off to Australia and will become a racehorse veterinarian. And as he's waving goodbye, he turns to Susan, his love, his wife, and he says, I won't live to see him again. And that turned out to be prophetic.
Isn't that eerie?
His life was filled with, he was definitely open to the spiritual side of life. Many of his colleagues, and he was told, don't believe in the jungle spirits that the elephant riders do. But he immersed himself in that world. He always felt that life was made up of much more than we could see.
Vicki, what happens to the elephants today?
Well, it's fascinating. The elephants, it's nearly 100 years later from when Billy Williams first arrived in Burma. And elephants have continued to be used in the logging industry in what's now Myanmar in the same way that they were, and in the elephant school which he established and his elephant hospitals, and much of what Billy Williams established all that time ago is still in place today. And conservationists believe that elephants, and we know it's happening with the slaughter of elephants throughout Asia, throughout Africa, and their habitats being eaten up. Elephants are being killed for their ivory. And we find in Myanmar today, Myanmar has the second largest population of Asian elephants in the world. They have the largest population of captive elephants in the world. And conservation groups are going into Myanmar to kind of find out the magic of these elephants, to make sure that as Myanmar opens up, we're not going to see clear-cutting equipment come in, take the job of elephants away from them, and have unemployed elephants. Believe it or not, that actually happens in India and Thailand. And so it's important for these elephants, there are thousands of them working, that they be maintained, that they continue. The nice thing about, it's crazy for those of us who love animals and always want to see them wild and free, that you would be rooting for elephants to be working for human beings. But as it turns out, logging has probably saved the elephants there and may continue to. And by the way, biologists today have gone back in, they've discovered these little biographies for each working elephant that Billy Williams used to keep himself, and they've got them going back to the 1930s.
Oh, isn't that something?
The scientists an archive, a rich, rich archive to draw on.
Thank you, Vicki, so much for your work and for this conversation. Vicki Constantine Croke, C-R-O-K-E, author of Elephant Company. It's at our website right now. The Faith Middleton Show airs at 3 and 9 p.m. on WNPR. Check out our guest lineup and join the conversation with us and other listeners on Facebook. Just search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to our talented team, producer Jonathan McNichol and senior producer Lori Mack. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.